I often try to insert myself into the biblical story. Imagining myself on the edge of the biblical scene, I try to take stock of the situation. What do I see? What do I smell? What do I feel? It's a way for me to integrate myself in the text and to see and experience the text in new ways. This morning we gather around a very interesting encounter from the Gospel of Mark. Mark's telling of Jesus' transfiguration comes right in the middle of his gospel. And this story, along with a larger portion of chapter 9, marks a turning point in Mark's gospel. Now, we, the readers, know the conclusion of Mark's gospel. We know the end. We know that when Jesus speaks of the Son of Man, he is referring to himself. But the disciples and the crowds are not blessed with this knowledge. The whole first half of Mark's gospel is sent in Jesus identifying himself, answering the question, who is this man Jesus? But in this section of chapter 9, there is a shift in Jesus' ministries. He continues to teach and he heals, but he also starts to prepare. He starts to prepare his disciples for what is to come. He foretells of pain and despair, of death and resurrection. And so this story, this transfiguration of Jesus, gains added significance. It is this experience which Peter, James, and John will remember and will help carry them through the second half of Mark's gospel and into their ministries beyond. This story, this transfiguration, is somewhat difficult for us to understand. It's foreign to our modern interpretations, our modern experiences. But the Greek word that Mark uses for the transfiguration comes from the same root as our word metamorphosis. And I think it helps explain what exactly Peter, James, and John saw on that mountain. Jesus' clothes did not just shine white, but Jesus physically changed. There was a metamorphosis, there was a transformation. Something happened. And this encounter, this is something that we can only explain in our modern minds as being some form of an expression of the triune God. This becomes the aha moment for the disciples. This becomes the moment where if there was any question in their minds as to who Jesus was, in this moment, that is erased. This is their mountaintop experience. This is that moment where everything came together and suddenly everything made sense. In this moment, their understanding was forever changed. Nothing could be viewed the same way again. Before coming to seminary, I spent many summers working at a camp and conference center. And as I recall my time at camp, there is one summer that particularly sticks out in my mind. Now, it sticks out not because it was the summer that I first heard God calling me to seminary, which it was. And it doesn't stick out because it's the summer that I started dating my wife, although that made it a good summer. No, what sticks out in my mind this summer is not what God was doing in my life, but what I could see God doing in and through the lives of the entire community. Everyone that worked that summer seemed to be intently looking for something, searching for something. They had this spiritual hunger to see all that they could, to discern all that they could, and to try to be all that they could. And as a chaplain, I got the distinct privilege of watching as each person throughout the course of the summer had that mountaintop experience, how they had that glimpse of understanding. Now, what triggered this moment was always different. It could be a moving worship or a deep conversation. And for some, it was just simply noticing how God is at work. But for all, the moment was similar. Everything slid into place. Everything was seen a little more clearly, heard a little more intently, and understood just a little bit better. In this moment, everything made sense. And suddenly, the presence of God was not something that they could feel out there working, but they very much felt it in here working. These moments are beautiful. They are powerful. Have you ever experienced a moment like this? A moment where the scales fell from your eyes and everything you saw was anew. A moment where God felt so close. In that moment, the mind is racing and the heart is beating, and the only desire is the desire to slow down, to sit down, to stop, to soak in all that you can, and to try to live right there in that moment. And that moment of clarity, that moment of understanding, that moment with God. That is exactly how Peter, James, and John felt. That moment of exaltation mixed with the desire to hold on to that experience. Peter exclaims, "Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us build three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Now, throughout Mark's Gospels, the disciples are often portrayed as good-hearted but somewhat thick-headed. They continually fail to grasp the meaning and significance of Jesus' teachings and actions. And my favorite example concerns their understanding of bread. And Joanna reminded us last week of Jesus feeding the 5,000. Five loaves of bread fed 5,000 people. Two chapters earlier, Jesus fed 4,000. Seven loaves of bread, 4,000 people. Two stories, almost 10,000 people fed, 12 loaves of bread. So you would think that by now the disciples would be able to cross bread off their list of worries for the day. Or at least they would remember to bring some with them when they go. But four verses after Mark's telling of the feeding of the 5,000, he begins the next story by saying, "Now the disciples had forgotten to take any bread with them. And when Jesus begins to warn them about the Pharisees and Herod, they say to one another, 'It's because we have no bread.'" If ever there was a depth of Jesus' patience, I think it was here. He says to them, "When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did I collect?" They said to him, 12. And he said, "The seven for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did I collect?" And they said, 7. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" That really is the disciples' mantra. Do you not yet understand? It's so easy to look at our text this morning and to think Peter just doesn't get it. This is just another example of his thick-headedness. But I think that would be wrong, because I think very much in this text, Peter got it. Peter, James, and John, they all got it. Their suggestions to build a dwelling was an invitation to invite Jesus and Elijah and a Moses in, and an invitation to stretch that moment out for as long as they could. They wanted to live in that clarity, in that understanding. They wanted to live there with God. And can you blame them? And I was reflecting as how we do very similar things. My wife, Callie, is a bereavement coordinator for a hospice outside of Atlanta. Her work revolves around providing care and support for anyone in the grief process. Her work is sometimes very difficult, but one of the things she loves is hearing people's stories. The stories of their love, the stories of their life, the stories of their mountaintops. In her work, she has encountered many people like Mary. Mary was married for a little over 40 years, until one afternoon just after lunch, when her husband was taken from her. Callie asked Mary once to tell her about her husband, and Mary's eyes lit up, tears beginning to well, and she said, "Well, I don't know why I'm going to tell you this, but over the course of 40 years, there were more than a few nights when I would wake up in the middle of the night not feeling very well. And out of concern, I didn't want to wake my husband. I would slip out of bed and I would head downstairs and I would fall asleep on the couch. Every time I would wake up in the morning and my husband would be there, curled up on the recliner next to me, pillow and blanket in tow. He never wanted me to be alone, even for a night. That was the kind of guy he was. Callie knew that Mary had seen the mountaintop. Mary had seen and been a part of a love that was so deep that it could only come from God. As you can imagine, her grief process was very difficult. But Mary built dwellings for her husband. Not physical dwellings, but she hung on to moments and memories that allowed her to stretch out her love and her marriage. Over a year after his death, her husband's razor was still sitting there beside the sink, still covered with hair from that morning shave. Mary could not bring herself to clean it, and as long as that razor remained there, a part of her husband remained there. From time to time, she would take his Jeep to run her errands. Every time she climbed in that Jeep, she could smell her husband. She could feel her husband. Mary built these dwellings because it helped her remember, and it helped give her the strength to carry on. Peter, James, and John, they got it. They wanted to hold on to this moment for as long as they could because they knew this was the moment that was going to help them carry on. But then a shadow of the cloud came over them, and I can imagine a faint smell of rain shook them from their experience. And a voice descended from the cloud, and this voice is a profound voice that does not judge or admonish, but rather is full of grace and mercy and love. It's the voice of God. It is the voice of love. It's God's gentle reminder that as much as we want to, or as much as we try to, we cannot live on top of the mountain. But in this verbal exchange, God gives us a gift. Something that we can carry with us wherever we go. It is a soft reminder that there is a love which will always be with us and can never be taken away. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. On April 3rd, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave a speech to a group of striking sanitation workers. Reverend King concluded his speech with his own mountaintop experience, his own witnessing of the Transfiguration. These were his final words that night. "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned with that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." The very next day, April 4th, that Dr. Martin Luther King, our brother in Christ, was assassinated. In this tragedy is the tension of this text. Our glimpses of the mountaintop, our glimpses of the promised land, do not fit with the tragedy and the pain that we see in this world. That same tension is what met Peter, James, and John as they descended from the mountain. They descended with that magical moment still in their minds, and they were met with the stark reality of this world. They arrive at the bottom of the mountain to see crowds of people, scribes arguing with the other disciples, and a boy that is possessed with an evil spirit so intense that the disciples cannot release it. In short, Peter, James, and John at the bottom of this mountain meet chaos. The juxtaposition of these two stories is intentional because this is life. We know all too well the stress and pressures of this world. We know that our faith is not easy and our burdens are not always light. What we see does not always make sense, and from time to time we will feel lost, confused, and in the midst of chaos. But we know that there is more in life than what we see. We know that we see only through a glass dimly, and right now we see only in part. The mountaintop reminds us not of how things are, but of how things can be and will be. We know that we do not live on the mountaintop, but from time to time, we are given a glimpse. And these glimpses fall like manna from heaven. They help nourish us, sustain us, and remind us of the ever-present hope of Christ. In these glimpses, it is these glimpses that give us strength and courage to carry on in difficult times. We are called to remember that light which we see on the mountain, and to know that that light continues to be with us, even when, especially when, we find ourselves walking through the valley of the shadow of death. As we prepare ourselves for Lent, we are reminded in this text that transformation is real. Hope is real. There is no situation that is too dark or too bleak for God's transforming power and redempting love. Faith, hope, and love abide these three. And the greatest of these is love. That voice which came down from the clouds on that mountaintop now echoes through the pains and valleys of our lives. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. Listen to him. Remember him. And we are left standing in need of courage. The courage to walk with the hope and love of God despite what we might see in this world. The courage to listen to this voice, to God's voice, which reminds us that the love of Jesus works in and through all of our lives. Faith, hope, and love abide these three. And the greatest of these is and always will be love. Amen.